You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pair.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
It's Friday, April 29th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, how an innocent trip to the library could give you arsenic poisoning. Plus, a new pterosaur fossil seems to confirm the prehistoric reptiles had some pretty cool feathers. And how would you like to meditate with Yoda and Chewbacca? Here's some cool stuff for your ride home. If you come across an old green book at an antique store or in the rare collections department of a library, maybe don't touch it. It could be poisonous, its cover or labels laced with arsenic. Now, granted, you probably won't be in danger if you merely brush your hand against the book or pick it up briefly. To really get the fatal effects of arsenic poisoning, you'd have to literally eat the whole book. But booksellers, librarians, and other people who handle these books with regularity could be at greater risk of ingesting particles of arsenic from the pigment used in the tomes, leading to side effects like lightheadedness, stomach cramps, and possible irritation or lesions on their skin. But where did these books come from, and why are they laced with arsenic? That's down to a particular type of pigment used widely back in the 19th century called emerald green, quoting National Geographic. Also known as Paris green, Vienna green, and Schweinfurt green, it's the product of combining copper acetate with arsenic trioxide, producing copper azotoarsenite. The toxic pigment was commercially developed in 1814 by the Wilhelm Dye and White Lead Company in Schweinfurt, Germany. It was used everywhere, from clothing and wallpaper to fake flowers and paint. To say that Victorian England was bathed in emerald green is an understatement. By 1860, more than 700 tons of the pigment had been produced in that country alone. Arsenic's toxicity was known at the time, but the vibrant color was nevertheless popular and cheap to produce. Wallpapers shed toxic green dust that covered food and coated floors, and clothing colored with the pigment irritated the skin and poisoned the wearer. Despite the risks, emerald green was ingrained into Victorian life, a color to literally die for. End quote. It was the millennial pink of its era, but with a fatal side effect. And here's where the books come into play. At the same time that this emerald green pigment started being used in so many different goods, there was a simultaneous evolution happening in bookbinding. Thanks to the Industrial Revolution, books were able to be cranked out faster and in more quantities than ever before. But the traditional leather binding of them was costly. Bookbinders had long tried using cheaper, clothing-like fabric to bind the books with, but to no avail. It was simply too weak for the bookbinding process. But in the 1820s, a publisher and a bookbinder teamed up to develop a process that coated the fabric in starch to make it sturdier, able to withstand the bookbinding process. This became the first commercially viable cloth-bound book process, and it fueled another mini-revolution in reading. With cloth being so much cheaper than leather, manufacturers could print way more books, and way more people could afford to buy them. Over the next couple of decades, there were further innovations in bookbinding, but according to National Geographic, a lot of the details of these processes were lost to time, because publishers would develop their own methods and keep them a secret from competitors. But we do have this, quoting again, "Bookmakers produced a colorful array of books with dyes, which are solutions that chemically bond to the substance they're applied to, and pigments, which are materials that physically coat the substance, like dried mud on a Sunday dress. As such, the era's most fashionable shade of green pigment could grace the covers of popular books. The trouble with pigments, though, is that they tend to crack, peel, and flake off over time." End quote. And enter the Poison Book Project, founded by Melissa Tadone, the lab head for library materials conservation at the Winterthur Museum, Garden, and Library in Delaware. Tadone stumbled upon one such emerald green book back in 2019, specifically a copy of Rustic Adornments for Homes and Taste, published in 1857. And while examining it to begin the conservation process, Tadone noticed colorant flaking off the book cloth rather easily in a way not typical for dyed cloth. It indicated to her that it had instead been mixed with a pigment. Tadone teamed up with the museum's head of scientific research and analysis to examine the book with an X-ray fluorescence spectrometer and a Raman spectrophotometer, the findings from which were able to positively identify the pigment in the book's cover as emerald green. From there, they headed to the University of Delaware, where the Director of Environmental Health and Safety was able to inform them about the contents of emerald green and the dangers of the arsenic within. They found that that particular book they'd been studying had an average of 1.42 milligrams of arsenic per square centimeter, and National Geographic notes that without medical care, a lethal dose of arsenic for an adult is about 100 milligrams, or about the mass of several grains of rice, which is not very much when you think about it. The experts at the University of Delaware advised Tadone and her colleagues to take extra precautions when handling any books containing the emerald green pigment to reduce the risk of inhalation, ingestion, or cross-contamination. Measures like wearing nitrile gloves, keeping the books off the shelves and sealed in polyethylene plastic bags, and wiping down surfaces after handling them. Tadone emphasized that these books don't need to be destroyed if found, just handled with care. The Poison Book Project has produced bookmarks explaining these same safety measures and sent them out to institutions around the U.S. and other countries. They're also working to find and catalog all of the books that contain the emerald green pigment, both for safety reasons and so they can continue to study the pigment with an ever larger sample size. And from the 88 books that they've cataloged so far, they found that the vast majority were produced during the 1850s specifically. And on their site, the Poison Book Project also keeps track of other toxic colorants from the era, including a whole separate arm for chrome yellow book cloth. These books appear in shades ranging from bright goldenrod to olive green, the latter of which indicates that the chrome yellow pigment was mixed with Prussian blue, the world's first ever synthetic pigment. Prussian blue is another one that was a huge hit when it was introduced in the 18th century. It was used widely in paints, such as for Peter van der Werf's Entombment of Christ and Vincent van Gogh's The Starry Night, as well as in ink, for stamps, and later for textile dyeing, laundry bluing, early photocopying, and even later a form of invisible ink in World War II. But also like emerald green, Prussian blue has a dark side. When mixed with diluted sulfuric acid, it becomes cyanide. This discovery was made by Carl Wilhelm Scheele, a chemist, in 1782. Scheele has discovered more natural elements than any other chemist, 7 in total, including oxygen. In addition to discovering cyanide, Scheele, coincidentally, manufactured emerald green, and he would be one of countless people to die a drawn-out, horrific death from overexposure to the deadly pigment. And if you want more on the story of Scheele, Prussian blue, and all kinds of accidentally fatal discoveries throughout history, I highly recommend the book When We Cease to Understand the World by Benjamin Labatut, translated to English by Adrian Nathan West. But for now, be careful what books you're picking up. It's okay to judge a book by its cover when the cover could literally kill you. You know how, at least in the book version of Jurassic Park, the idea that the dinosaurs were wiped out mostly by an asteroid is still just one of many hypotheses being hotly debated? Or how, more than likely, when you were in school, you were taught that we didn't actually know how the dinosaurs went extinct? But in the last couple of decades, not only have most people come to accept the Alvarez hypothesis, that is, an asteroid impact caused the mass extinction, but we also now know that many dinosaurs were not the scaly, bear beasts we long imagined, but rather covered in feathers like their avian brethren. Well, yet another Jurassic-era reptile has been found based on fossil evidence to have had feathers, potentially putting to rest decades-old debates among paleontologists about whether this particular type of reptile did or did not have feathers. Pterosaurs, or at least T. imperator, did indeed have feathers along the bottom of its trademark huge head crest, according to this most recent study. First, some context from Inverse. Quote, pterosaurs soared through Earth's skies as early as 220 million years ago in the Triassic period, before going extinct with their dinosaur cousins at the end of the Cretaceous. They share a common ancestor with dinosaurs, but exist as their own class of ancient flying reptiles. Many pterosaur fossils have hair-like structures called pycnofibers. It's not entirely sure what pycnofibers were used for or what exactly they looked like, though some research shows they might actually be early feathers. In 2018, researchers reported in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution that the pycnofibers of two juvenile pterosaur specimens from China appeared to take on several forms. Some were simple and tube-shaped, but others appeared to branch apart. Instead of it all resembling individual hairs, some of the fluff on these Jurassic-era pterosaurs looked more like primitive feathers. End quote. And those findings from 2018 were enough to convince some folks, but not all. And now, an additional specimen from Brazil that lived millions of years after those earlier specimens has been analyzed by a team led by paleontologists from University College Cork, and its findings, published recently in the journal Nature, underscore that the specimens from China were not just a fluke. Co-author Marie McNamara points out that finding a pterosaur from a different region, different time period, and different species makes a strong case that feathers were common for pterosaurs in general. And Inverse points out that means feathers actually would have evolved about 70 million years earlier than previously thought. Perhaps dinosaurs and pterosaurs shared a common feather-clad ancestor. And this 115 million-year-old fossilized head crest also sheds some interesting light on the coloration of T. imperator's feathers and their similarity to some modern birds. Quoting McNamara in Science Daily, in birds today, feather color is strongly linked to melanosome shape. Since the pterosaur feather types had different melanosome shapes, these animals must have had the genetic machinery to control the colors of their feathers. This feature is essential for color patterning and shows that coloration was a critical feature of even the earliest feathers. End quote. And while the scientists don't yet have confirmation on the purpose of the varying color patterns, it's likely they could have been used for attracting mates, scaring off predators, or as camouflage. And as Gizmodo points out, advanced X-ray technology is close to being rolled out that will help us learn even more about the soft tissue of pterosaurs and dinosaurs, and potentially unlock all kinds of findings that will continue to make Jurassic Park potentially even more outdated and inaccurate. Or perhaps stand the test of time and knowledge. If you're looking to unwind a little, the popular meditation app Headspace has a new collaboration launching soon with Star Wars. Just in time for Star Wars Day on May the 4th, better known as my birthday, Headspace will be releasing several 5-minute animated Breathe with Star Wars exercises that feature Yoda, BB-8, Chewbacca, and R2-D2, as well as themed sleep casts, at least one of which includes the background sounds of porgs. Quoting Mashable, with Breathe with Yoda, every time you inhale, Yoda's eyes will close and his hand will stretch out and levitate an X-Wing. On exhale, it'll descend back into the Dagobah swamp. Chewbacca's meditation is fittingly focused on managing strong emotions, so you'll join him in the forest on his home planet Kashyyyk. In R2-D2's meditation, the cheeky droid will move in a zigzag motion up and down the screen, and in the same fashion, BB-8 will roll from side to side. For sleepy, scruffy nerf herders, the collaboration will see 3 new sleep casts, stories meant to soothe you to sleep, set in Star Wars locations, letting users drift off to the sounds of ships and landscapes of a galaxy far, far away. End quote. Those stories will be just a little bit different each time you listen, as is standard for all Headspace sleepcasts. And as for other ways to celebrate Star Wars Day this year, Disney Plus will be releasing a Disney Gallery special for the Book of Boba Fett, basically a behind-the-scenes featurette. And I will also put a link in the show notes to a bunch of deals and discounts that will be running on various Star Wars games across platforms. Although personally, I think trying to practice mindfulness with a breathing exercise led by Chewbacca is a game enough in itself. Well, yesterday I very enthusiastically shared the news that a Michael J. Fox documentary is coming soon to Apple Originals, and now Variety has reported that there is also a Gene Wilder documentary in the works. Produced by White Horse Pictures, the movie will be directed by Chris Smith, who directed the Netflix version of the Fyre Festival documentaries, and is being made in close collaboration with fellow filmmaker Gene Wilder's nephew, Jordan Walker Perlman. Walker Perlman has been protective over his uncle's story in the past, as he was very close to the actor and comedian, even living with him a bit while growing up. And very little information has been released so far about the upcoming film, but it intends to cover much of Wilder's life, from his start on stage through many of his hit films like The Producers, Young Frankenstein, and Willy Wonka, as well as his personal life, including his relationship with fellow late comedian Gilda Radner. And I'll put a bonus plug here for Gilda Radner's autobiography, It's Always Something. It was written in the final years and days of her life as she underwent treatment for ovarian cancer, so it's definitely a bit of a gut punch, but it is so, so good. Full of a lot of joy and laughs for such a tough subject, and it does include an epilogue written by Wilder. I haven't read it since 2005, but I imagine it still holds up. And that is going to be it from me for this week. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I will talk to you again on Monday.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.